and welcome back to the TFT podcast. I'm Ryan, and that's not Matt. It's Cognac. Hey, Cognac, take me to the river.
Hello. I'm guesting for this podcast while we talk about more songs about buildings and food.
It's a really good David Byrne impression that you have, almost like in your attempt to sound really normal and like you're fitting in, you end up sounding way more robotic. So we're off to an awesome start here on this special 1978 edition. So we're continuing on our train. Last week we did Blondie's Parallel Lines, and we actually saw an opportunity to stay right in. We're not really budging from the Bowery, right, from the East Village, from CBGB, long before it's a John Varvatos store, long before you can get a burger with pork on top. You had the Talking Heads playing in the same nightclubs as Blondie and Television, so we're kind of continuing our late 70s run. So if you've not listened to Talking Heads' second album, More Songs About Buildings and Food, as always, go and listen to it on Spotify, stream it, click an affiliate link on there in the show notes, or get the vinyl. Like Cognac and I actually have this on vinyl from a record store, and so you know, support your local small businesses. Give it a listen, and we'll see you back here in about 45 minutes after this word from our sponsors. Are you a boy suffering through all of the girls who want to be with the girls?
I want to do some abstract analysis.
Well, maybe you should just become an artist, because this club is artists only. No girls allowed.
That's okay. I'm a left-brain thinker.
And we're back. Yeah, so, you know, I guess this is a record that we bought together, right? Not to go, you know, too biographical, too public, you know, piercing the veil of anonymity that we have carefully constructed for you here in this world. But guys, listeners, you know, for those of you who are, you know, Cognac has not been on for a while, actually, probably since the Gossip Girl days. But we're an item.
That's right. We are together.
We are together in right now beside each other.
We're together on so many planes of existence, a metaphysical, a physical one, spiritual, emotional.
And musical. We're together on a musical level.
No, that's right. I remember that summer when we got this record as being a summer of acquisition.
It was 2005, right?
That's right. And we were really in the throes of trying to acquire a lot of vinyl.
Because we had just acquired a record player, right? That my brother gave me a record player for my birthday. And it's interesting. We've never talked a lot. We've talked about vinyl technology on the podcast. I don't think I've talked about my record player, which is a record player that he got on eBay from an elementary school that was liquidating it. So it's one of these, if you remember this, if you went to school at a certain time, like I'd say in the 80s or before, you might recognize this kind of school record player that is one compact unit. It has a handle on it and a lid, so it's meant to be carried from classroom to classroom. But my brother thought it was pretty cool and has a built-in speaker, right? So it's portable, but also is a good starter record player. It's sturdy. I mean, I still have it. This was almost 9 years ago, I believe. This was the summer of 2005, and so I got that record player, and then shortly after that, Rachel Cognac.
Okay, my cover is blown.
Cognac.
That's right, and I remember, you know, this was a particularly sought out record because we were really at the time interested in acquiring albums by the Talking Heads. We were really drawn to the kind of reputation of the Talking Heads as being very conversant in their music, with kind of African beats and a sort of like a very heavy focus on percussion and interesting rhythms. And bonus points, this album is produced by Brian Eno. In fact, it's the first of several collaborations with Brian Eno.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to kind of peel out like the cycles of our tastes at that time, right? And I actually talked about this a little bit in this stretch through the 70s, because, like, you know, I've been very excited of this stretch, right? So when we talked about punk, when we talked about the Ramones and the Sex Pistols, interestingly, these are records that I actually have only gotten into recently in the last couple of years, but that the and I know that you have a longer history with punk music, less the Sex Pistols, but the Ramones and the Clash, who we're talking about in a few weeks, you were into as a teenager. But interestingly, in this post-collegiate period, so for me, the years like 2004, 2005, well, because in 2003, I was getting into the indie rock and roll, right? The indie rock. And then I think, I don't know if I burned out, the bands, many of the bands that I was into at that time, these kind of a second wave of post-punk bands were starting to burn out. Bands like Q and Not You, Les Savis Fav was touring less frequently, the Dismemberment Plan had broken up, right? All these bands of the late 90s, early 2000s that were the bands that we were really getting into around that time were all kind of disbanding or not producing as much output. And so I think that we were really, you know, this period of the late 70s of post-punk or early new wave was it, like you say, was really appealing, because what was really in indie rock at the time was what was put under a header of dance punk. And it was sometimes it was called post-punk revival, sometimes it was called dance punk, and it was some of those bands that I listed, but also LCD Sound System was part of this. Interpol was even loosely grouped in, The Rapture.
It's funny you mention this, you know, quote, dance punk revival, because so many of those bands really, you know, I mean, it's very, the indebtedness that they have actually to the New York art scene of the time that we're covering now, where I think so many of the podcasts have been really circling around, that music is so indebted to that, to the no wave stuff,
right?
Really, to a lot of things. It's funny how so many of the cultural milestones of indie rock and present day indie culture are really just a continual rehash and cribbing of stuff that happened in the late 70s in New York.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, is that the two, I mean, that's fascinating, in that the that there was this brief hiatus, right? That it was like there was this a set of artistic expression, musical expression, fashion that was going on in Lower Manhattan in the late 70s, and then it's like, seems like New York just disappeared. It disappeared into Warriors Land for a decade. And then, you know, I guess like Giuliani, like, saved, like, steered it back out, right? Giuliani made the world safe for hipsters again.
I think that's a controversial opinion you just voiced.
So. Well, this is the motherfucking TFT podcast. Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani is the reason that Williamsburg is how it is today.
Yeah, who did he make it safe for? Think about it. No, but on, I mean, that actually is a question worth unpacking, but maybe not for this podcast.
This is the podcast. Look, we unpack more things than people coming home from a vacation. Like, this is what we do on this podcast. We are like, this is the conceptual equivalent of moving into a new apartment, and all you have to do is unpack. say I in our apartment that has not yet been unpacked. That we've lived in for some time now, our new apartment. So I guess I've been unpacking more concepts than boxes.
It's the type of unpacking where you unload the dirty laundry, but you place it in a pile and then proceed to forget about it for weeks.
Well, right. I mean, listen, it's hard to prioritize. You have to just start making piles at a certain point. So we're making little conceptual piles. I think that, I mean, to circle all this back, that there is some level of continuity that was there, and I think that was why we started hearing that these bands, because I had not had any real understanding of the Talking Heads as a band that was a dot in this line of what was cool and of a kind of punk legitimacy. I think this echoes builds on something that we talked about that Matt and I talked about last week, is that in part this was because I associated the Talking Heads as an 80s band, right? That they are that 80s band. They are a new wave band, and not even exactly a new wave band, just like a shimmery, goofy band. And I think that me in my, like, you know, and even then, I don't think I'd had quite as many clear senses of punk authenticity. If anything, you know, our generation that were born in the 80s, teenagers and pre-teenagers in the 90s, we have, so the other line that got kind of picked up later is, I think that the notions of punk authenticity that morphed into notions of indie authenticity kind of come from the 90s, from grunge, right? That there's a sense that the dirty music of grunge is more real than the shimmery music of the 80s. And we actually talked about that with Blondie as, you know, we're starting to see and hear more synthesizers, more keyboards, in this late 70s period, but they're in this more man-machine hybrids at this time. And so you actually hear that, that it's really interesting, right, that this is, you know, chronologically post-punk, and I think we'll want to talk about the ways in which is, you know, again, unpack a little bit the meaning of post-punk, what it means to be post-punk, and what it means to be a new wave of what. But I think that a lot of what we found what we were looking for in these Talking Heads records. And I don't know the sequence of, you know, right around that time when we were starting to acquire these records, we also saw the Talking Heads film, the 80s concert film, Stop Making Sense, and it just blew our minds. I think that and that's like a high recommendation, is to, if you've never seen Stop Making Sense, which is a concert film, but a unusual concert film in that it was a concert conceived as a film, or a film concert, right? It was a film concert directed by Jonathan Demme, right, who went on to direct The Silence of the Lamb, among other things, and it's this very artfully staged stage show and conceptual art piece, and I think that and the kind of weirdness in that and the extremeness picked up and even amplified what we were looking for in our music and what we were finding lacking.
I want to add to that too, that around the same time we were acquiring these albums, we also did acquire the live album. Name of this band is Talking Heads, which I think is very difficult to find, but if you can find it, I highly recommend it, because that live album, I think, really also, it kind of confirmed your notions of punk legitimacy. I feel like you can just hear them in that album. You hear the immediacy of the music, how driving it is, how it just is this very visceral experience listening to that live album that really sold the Talking Heads for me as an interesting and exciting band.
I mean, it's interesting because of the cover of that. There's like a series of photographs. It may even be like a film is taken and the individual like frames of the film are spliced out to be sequential photographs on that album cover of the live album. It looks as if on the first half, like the first cover, there's kind of two covers, one for the earlier, it's a two disc album. The first album is stuff from this 77, 78 period. And then I think the second album is a little later stuff, and is kind of already a more fleshed out band, moving towards even more of the auxiliary percussion, more of the more expansive synths that you saw in the 80s. But the first one, it like the photo looks like they're playing in somebody's living room, right? That and so it is even more, right? It's like if CBGB's has gotten played out, where do you go? You go into people's living rooms, right? And this is just you know, like we're just at home, right? And I think that there's an interesting set of questions because David Byrne, right, doesn't look like Johnny Rotten, right? And what's the transgressive thing that David Byrne does that he's famous for? He wore a suit that was huge, and other than that, right? He's wearing these button-down Oxford shirts, you know, feeling pretty straight-laced. Which actually brings me to a question that I want to ask of you, Cognac. which is these talking heads with their buildings and their food and their Oxford shirts and their rivers to which they are being taken to, are they normcore?
I want to say yes. I want to say that they are normcore. And I want to touch...
The answer is always yes.
Is the answer always yes? I didn't know that. I didn't know those were the hidden rules of the podcast.
Well, the answer is always no.
Well, but here... All right. I want to get into why I think they are normcore and why I think... And for the viewer... Or not viewers, excuse me. For the listeners,
they're looking at something. Unless, let us know in the comments. What do you look at when you listen to our podcast? Do you just kind of turn out the lights and just let yourself drift away? And we are like two beings entering your mind space. Do you like stare at one thing?
Hello. So that's if you want to stare off into space.
Do you like pick one object and stare at it? Like do you have like a totem, a TFT totem object that you stare at, or do you are you a normal person who like does household chores and commuting while listening to this podcast? So because in a way, right? Unless you are closing your eyes, you're a viewer of something. You're not a viewer of us. You're a listener to us, but we are still all viewers.
Well, to the listeners, pop culture consumers, and viewers of the world out there, I think your audience tends to be pretty familiar with what's going on in the popular culture, but normcore...
Well, and yes, Marvin Gaye told them what's going on.
Got it. But you know, normcore is...
Oh, and we had a whole episode on normcore.
You had a whole episode on normcore. All right. Well, then I need not digress anymore. But yes, I do think there's a lot to be said that this is, you know, the one of the first normcore bands. And I think it's interesting that you focus on David Byrne and the kind of aesthetic preppy look he has. In one of the Rolling Stone reviews for this album in particular, a lot of hay was made about how much David Byrne looks like the actor who played Norman Bates in Psycho, which whose name is he's failing it. The name is escaping me, but
Anthony Perkins.
Thank you. Yes, that he looks a lot like Anthony Perkins in his frame and face, and I actually think it's an interesting. That's an interesting comparison in that, you know, that song came out the summer that
Psycho Killer
came out the summer that Son of Sam was in New York.
Which would have been 77, right?
Which would have been 77.
Yeah, so the year before, right? That's off of, it's convenient, right? Because their first record is Talking Heads 77.
Yes.
So it just distinguishes, it sets a nice start marker. That's their first album. It's in 77. And then they kind of did like an album a year. Their first three were all 77, 78, 79. And then there was a hiatus of a few years.
But I think there is there's an embrace of the things that are off within the facade of normalcy or convention. I think there's a lot of the strain living within convention, but straining against it and being feeling just sort of that inner turmoil of straining against convention.
Yeah, though I think that's exactly right. And I think that that's – so we've talked about normcore a little bit as this kind of tortured attempt or a deliberate attempt to not stand out, to be the same as everyone and kind of embrace sameness and empathy. But it's in being deliberate that itself is very not normal. That heightened level of self-awareness and kind of social awareness, and it's very different, right, from being basic, right, from being actually average, right, and being unreflectedly so, right. So the Talking Heads are very not basic, but they're normcore because they're trying so hard to be normal, right? That in some ways, right, the like being a psycho killer is the most normcore thing of them all, because I'm totally normal, and yet yet you're not, like, because you're killing people, right? And that and that kind of perspective that's in Psycho Killer about, like you say, fighting this strain and kind of delivering these lists of, like, I'm doing normal people things. I will show you how normal I am by listing all of the normal things that I am doing. Look at the normal things I am doing. There's this great, I'll see if I can find it. I think it's an extra from Stop Making Sense, where David Byrne interviews himself. And it's so stilted and kind of staring into space almost, right? And it's in our time, like, we would definitely, in our kind of casual, probably harmful self-diagnosis, we just say, oh, yeah, David Byrne, he's super aspy, right? That, like, but it feels both constructed and a performed and yet genuine awkwardness. So there's maybe a natural awkwardness that then is doubled down upon as a performance choice.
That's right. I think, you know, all of them have an art background. They all met in the Rhode Island School of Design. I do think that their choices, as you were saying, that normcore is sort of a tortured approach to normcore or to normalcy and convention and basicness. But in performing those things, you are not being basic. You know, they have the art student mentality. I think so many of the other bands of this time that have been discussed or that were in this sort of CBGB's thing had more of. They had more of this art mindset in their approach, and that the sort of stripped down aesthetic and in both in the music and in the sort of performance and aesthetics was much more of a choice and a performance than not. And I think the Talking Heads do go off of that. I also want to talk about Psycho Killer, and some of the things you said made me think about how it's in this long line of other songs. It's almost, I would call it, kind of a, there's like arguments in postmodernism about how when we classify, you know, people who are outside or mental, by classifying things as being abnormal or unusual, it's just a way to construct, it's a social political construction meant to marginalize and oppress certain kinds of people.
Right, and so this is like some of Foucault's work on mental illness, right?
Yes, and I think this Psycho Killer in ways has a lot of in common with something like, for example, Devo's Mongoloid,
yeah,
right, which... Pot, you know, where I think the whole sort of quote punchline of that song is that, you know, the mongoloid, and apologies for using that term, but I am just using the name of the song and the term used in the song.
Also, spoilers for Devo's Mongoloid.
Right. Sort of the gist of that song is that the mongoloid in the center of the narrative is just a guy who goes to work every day.
Right.
And again, I think that, you know, that song and Psycho Killer, they kind of place this kind of emphasis on, well, who is really supposed to be marginalized? Who is really mental, you know, who is ill? Who's the person here that should be seen as strange or abnormal?
The Psycho Killer's inside us all.
Right.
Right. Right. So that's like the interesting thing is that, I mean, that's an interesting perspective on normcore, is that by adopting and kind of adopting normalcy as a pose from a perspective of still kind of interest, like self-important, interesting creativity. On the one hand, it seems like very appropriative and kind of insincere and just kind of the worst of hipsterism. But I think there's something interestingly is that there is something at its possible best or possibly most compelling is that there is this interesting idea of empathy of that within every normal person, there's a potential psycho killer and a potential artist, right? There's a potential weirdo, right? And it's believing in the inner weirdo that is I think what's in a lot of this music. And I think to kind of segue, to kind of drill down into the album a little more, I have another question. Which of these songs are about buildings and food? Because I've listened to this album hundreds of times, and I don't hear anything about architecture or restaurantage. Like, there's no recipes, right? There are no recipes for, like, chicken Florentine on this album. Like, so, Rachel, I ask you, like, in what way is this an album about buildings and food? Is it mislabeled? Did I just break you?
A little bit. Wait, can I say yes or no? Or is there still only one answer? I'm confused. So here's my kind of facetious little answer, is that it's about buildings and food, and that it's about food being emotional relationships and interpersonal dynamics between men and women.
It's
and
about then, the pot roast of the soul, right?
Yes, yeah, so it's the pot roast of the soul, and then buildings about being not really about buildings, obviously, but more about the architecture of these sort of urban spaces we inhabit and the push and pull of living. Sort of, I think the push and pull of being in an urban space and being the anonymity that comes with that, and also the desire to take up emotional and physical space. So I think the album has songs about buildings in the sense that buildings are about space and the way and they take up space.
I think that's exactly right, and that like then really fits into a line of what we've been talking about with a lot of what's going on here is tensions of urbanism and suburbanism, mm-hmm. And it's there in we talked about it a lot in a few weeks ago in both television and in Bowie's Heroes, right? Of, you know, in Bowie's case, the architecture that was really relevant is the Berlin Wall, right? He's in West Berlin and is building next to is recording next to this very important piece of architecture that is like kind of setting the boundaries and structure of the Western world, dividing the West from the East. And in television, it feels very. We talked about their bound jams, and that there being these social structures and physical structures that are providing the structure in which the exploration is happening. And so, I think that's exactly right. Is that all of these songs are about interpersonal relationships and about reflections on boys and girls, right? And about the articulation of self in space. And so it's really, I mean, it's also, as we talk this out, like, you know, we talked about, when Matt and I talked about The Velvet Underground, we sort of say you can get to anywhere from here kind of musically. And I think what's kind of fascinating about the Talking Heads is that you can kind of get to anywhere, you can see everywhere from here kind of conceptually. That, you know, this idea of the articulation of space and rearticulation of city space is has been a big, you know, concern of Matt and mine throughout the life of TFT, and kind of we brought in Matthew Barney pretty early on, right? So that idea and kind of it coming from these mixed media arts and in Matthew Barney's work in film and sculpture connects in really interesting ways to what's being done musically and lyrically and performatively here on this album. And then some of these other ideas about just the kind of genericness of boys and girls connect in really interesting ways to another band we've talked about in TFT, which is the Hold Steady, right? Mm-hmm. And that there's in the kind of Craig Finn's Sprechgesang style There's a connection back through David Byrne, back to Lou Reed, to even in a way Bob Dylan, right? So there's these interesting lines that go in every direction from this record. So it is interesting that these songs are. It's really an interesting rhetorical move to be saying, well, these are just more songs about buildings and food, because what are they going to say? Like more songs about my creeping sense of existential dread, right? Because that's really what they are, right?
Well, but then they would have been an emo band, or I think that's the sensibility that emo bands bring to the table, or at least the more commercialized ones.
What I know is that the emo songs are actually about buildings and food. Like, it's about like taking a shit into a toilet. is really what the emo songs are about. They purport to be, they flip it, right? Because they purport to be about their existential dread, but it's really just about taking a huge dump after eating a big meal. And so, I don't know. So, are there any songs here that, like, what songs on the album jump out at you as exemplifying this, and as being either, in one way or another, either being lyrically interesting, or as just being the songs on the album that always catch your attention when you listen to it? Like, what, do you remember what was the first song on this record that you really got into?
Yeah, I would say it actually is the Girls Want to Be with the Girls song.
Right, what is it about that other than, is it like, I am a girl? with me last week when Debbie Harry talked about a social scientist, it's like, all right! So it's like, I'm a girl, I want to be with, Are you trying to tell me that you want to be with the girls?
Wait. No, this is not the time or place for that announcement that's not coming. I think just at a real base, kind of boring level, you know, there's an immediacy to that song. It has this very kind of driving dance beat. I would say it has a pulsing dance beat. As is very interesting, I really have no idea how they created that twinkly sound in the back of this track.
Well, that's David Byrne, right? Brian Eno.
Brian Eno. So, you know, there's some Brian Eno sweet magic on this track that really just stands out even amongst the other.
It's basically Brian Eno's, like, sonic MSG, right? Right? He has this thing that creates that, like, umami for your ears. And we talked about this a bit on the... on Bowie Cast, when we talked about Heroes, because produced that, and it also it's this flattening yet deepening and kind of creating these shiny pieces. And I think it's ultimately constructed with bits of reverb and feedback that are then created to create, though, this kind of robotic and kind of uncanny valley, right, of
yes.
humanity, right? So that kind of is where, and Chris Gow talks about this in his review, where, like, Eno's sonic predilections for creating this shininess, sonic shininess, kind of... intersect with Byrne's lyrical tendencies as being this kind of sort of human and sort of not human.
No, it's interesting though. It's the kind of shininess you're describing in the production, because that description almost makes it sound like something that I might not want to listen to, because I tend to prefer production that doesn't sound overly clean. So, for example, I was trying to listen. I remember listening to the alt rock '90s band Garbage when I was older. I liked it a lot as a preteen, and I just found it so hard to listen to because it felt so slick and overproduced, and everything sounded so fake. All the instruments, the mix just sounded so clean and fake and terrible. Whereas I agree that
sounded like a true '90s child, right?
Yes,
like a true because that was a shiny turd in a grunge world, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was
It's a
good record, but just it sounds so it's so difficult for me to listen to when I tend to prefer things that sound sludgier, reverb. I just have those preferences, and maybe they're goofy preferences, but I have them. Whereas I think you're right that Brian Eno manages to sound clean, produce, synthetic, but in this way that still retains a kind of lo-fi character.
Yeah, absolutely. That's like an amazing, and it's hard to know whether that is a result of the tools that he was using. It's like being very sophisticated with simple tools, or whether there is just a actually just being so sophisticated that he can make it sound like it's not sophisticated, right? Mm-hmm. That looks like he makes it look like he's not trying really hard.
That's right. Well, so this song, I think, also stands out. It stands out in a little bit because it has more of this dance beat. There's less of a kind of funky rhythm. There's less like a kind of funky feel to it. It almost sounds more like a disco song than not, in the kind of pulsating beat. And then the lyrics, which I think we'll get into in a minute, are just so... It's interesting. You mentioned the Hold Steady and Craig Finn, who I think tends to have more of, you know, by creating this intense world with such specificity, guesses a kind of universality about being a teenager. A lot of these lyrics are very vague, and they seem purposefully vague. And maybe part of the normcore approach is to be these purposefully vague and abstract conceptual lyrics that are not specific.
Right. I mean, it's just like there's girls and there's boys, right? There's not Holly and Gideon and the banks of the Mississippi River, right? Like, that is just boys and girls, right? So if the Hold Steady talks about boys and girls in America, like the Talking Heads talk about boys and girls in a vacuum.
Right. These boys and girls are in a vacuum. And, you know, as you listen to it, to me, this song evokes a kind of adolescence, middle school adolescence, when girls are developmentally more mature. And there's the song seems to me, the way I read this is that the song kind of locates the girl and boy relationship in that time, where the girls are just developmentally so far ahead of the boys and are leaving them in the dust. And they just can't relate to the boys because they're just so advanced at this point in their development.
I think that's exactly right. But I think what's interesting is that it is kind of positing David Byrne and or many people as like perma-tweens, right? And it's interesting because there's articles out now, and there's kind of some think pieces about kind of ends of adulthood, and there's, it's a constant kind of, there's different versions of these kind of think piece cottage industry that have come up, but you know, right, so some of these lyrics, right, are that, you know, girls want things that make common sense, the best for all concerned, they don't have to go out of their way, and the girls want to be with the girls, and then later on, right, we joked about this earlier, right, the girls are getting into abstract analysis, they want to make intuitive leap. They're making plans that have far-reaching effects, and girls want to be with the girls. And I think that that's exactly... I think it's this interesting thing where it is this read of, on the one hand... Right, so there's these interesting things where, on the one hand, it is about kind of painting a picture of... I mean, it's really interesting because... This is a coldly analytic portrait of I'll tell you what, maybe he was a late bloomer, but David Byrne sure got into abstract analysis, right? And so that he, I mean, that's an interesting thing where it's almost that, like, David Byrne also wants to be with the girls. And so, like, to be with the girls, he wants to think like the girls, right? That he is kind of almost, on the one hand, is awkward, and is kind of awkward and alone. But rather than emoing about it, he's going to say, I'm thinking of cause and effect. I'm putting two and two together. I'm getting myself together.
And a lot of the way you describe that, it just kind of emphasizes to me what is the very stilted nature of these lyrics too. Mm-hmm. The lyrics are vague, they're stilted. I think that ties in on the sense of the kind of robotic tension, the man and machine tension throughout the album, that's just inherent in the production. And even in some ways, the feelings of alienation, the themes of alienation in this song, I think in the stilted language, evokes a sense of that something was mistranslated. Even what the girls want is so garbled and has been mistranslated that it's just beyond comprehension to the boys, who are literally asking, "What do you mean? What do you mean?"
Well, that's interesting, because that is a so common in the world of the Talking Heads, right, is about the name of the band, well, like, the name of the band is Talking Heads. And also and this comes from a joke in which David Byrne would say, like, the name of this band is the Talking Heads, and then the name of this song is Warning Sign, the name of this song is Psycho Killer, and would say this in this way, Stop Making Sense is about intelligibility. The album, their fifth studio album, is called Speaking in Tongues. So there's so much about intelligibility and unintelligibility that I think is exactly right. And there is this, you're absolutely right, that there's this kind of babblefish characteristic to the songs, that it was written in a language and then translated several times, and it became a copy of a copy.
No, and these ideas of unintelligibility actually, I think, tie back to some of the stuff we were talking about with Psycho Killer and the Devo song about the, you know, when we talk about unintelligibility, in some ways, I think you're also talking about what is normal or not normal, right? I think the way we describe normalcy and normal behavior and convention, you know, there's a certain amount of when things are don't adhere to convention, they're unintelligible to people. We don't understand. We can't make sense of them, and they don't read.
Well, right, and it's also it speaks to a way of, like, coping with unfamiliar social situations. Right, when you talk about norms, one definition of social norms is what is average behavior. So you seek to just do what everyone else is doing. But if you are doing that, right, that is in some ways a definition of awkwardness, is the stress caused by actively processing what is normal. And because, like, the other sense of norms is that it is an internalized sense of what you should be doing, right? And once you kind of are on norm overdrive, norm autopilot, that you don't have to process it all the time, right? That you kind of have internalized it, and there's a sense of habits of appropriateness, right? These are scholars like March and Olson talk about a logic of appropriateness that says, just, what do I do? What does a person like me do in this situation? You're not always calculating, but that there is a sense of norm overload, and if you're always assessing normal behavior by observing it and adapting, and that kind of uses up your emotional cognitive RAM.
Mm.
You know, does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, and it's interesting. I also think that ties back to this idea of, you know, the sense that, at least based off of that quote in the Rolling Stone article, that the way people viewed David Byrne was as, you know, an abnormal person in a normal man's persona or body. You know, the weirdo in the preppy clothes.
He's the quiet type, right? It's always the quiet types that either are mass murderers or start conceptual post-punk bands.
And you know, I think a lot of this album has this sense of, you know, both in the music is tense, the whole feeling of this album is very tense, and I think a lot of it, to me, strikes at that tension of using up that emotional RAM, of being smart enough to internalize norms but not wanting to follow them,
or being smart enough to recognize them but not smart enough to actually just, like, internalize it, right? To just become normal, to allow yourself to, like, let go and take, you know, give control to the autopilot. I mean, I think another song that does this is one that I really like, which is always, I think, the first The first couple songs on the album are really good, but the one that really grabs me as being, like, every time I listen to it, is really kind of where the album starts to really ramp up for me is The Good Thing, right? And the chorus, goes, a straight line exists between me and the good things. I have found the line, and its direction is known to me. Absolute trust keeps me going in the right direction. Any intrusion is met with a heart full of the good thing. And right, that's exactly like, it's like, I'm doing it right. I am good. I mean, this is also kind of speaks to this kind of psycho killer idea. It's like, nope, I'm not going to kill anyone because I know the good things. And what's amazing is this song is pretty, kind of, it's not tight. It's kind of, there's kind of building. There's kind of a in the structure of the song, kind of building tension, and then there's this breakdown, right? This is a song that ends in this just like rave up, that's just like really funk jam, and I feel like that's like one of these moments of release. Where it's like, and I think that is this counterpoint, and I don't know that it's interesting that I feel like that is actually. I mean, that's an interesting question. Like, I actually don't think the funk breakdown is the good thing. I think the funk breakdown is what's bubbling under the surface and is actually letting go to is when you go off of the straight line, right? Because it's very bouncy. It's nonlinear. Mm-hmm. And so there's a spiraling out of giving in to the bad thing that I think is going on here.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned the funk breakdown, because that makes me want to turn to Found a Job, which has a very long breakdown at the end.
Well, and that's like also like, right, so that's, this is all part of the first side, right? And there's just this amazing stretch, like kind of that it just builds up to this fever pitch. And actually from Boys or from Girls Want to Be with the Girls kind of goes right into Found a Job. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, what speaks to you about Found a Job?
Well, actually, mentioning that it goes right into Found a Job, you've just went through the pulsating dance beat of Girls Want to Be with the Girls, where we talk about the unintelligibility of women to the boys. And then you're put in this suburban situation. There's one of marital, kind of, it's some sort of marital strife, where essentially, you know, through, I guess, the kind of like a playfulness and imaginativeness, the couple seems to find each other and to reconnect. I mean, is that, do you think that's like a fruitful description of what's going on in the song?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, right, it's a kind of relationship or marriage that's become stale, and they're kind of taking out, right, the lyrics are, take that, damn that television, what a bad picture, don't get upset, it's not a major disaster, there's nothing on tonight, he said, I don't know what's the matter, nothing's ever on, she said, so I don't know why you bother. I mean, this is interesting, because this is actually, what's really interesting about this is that this actually is like a normal voice, right? The David Byrne is actually observing people, but now then reporting in like, Clippy, the humanoid robot voice. He is quoting people, and that sound really normal of this kind of bickering couple. And they, and it's really, what I love about this song is that what makes this relationship work is pretending you're on TV, right? That they are, inventing your own sitcom, inventing your own your TV show. And I think that I've always found this also as being prescient about reality television, right? It's like, this is like hyper reality television. And that, you know, the most real reality TV is the reality TV in your life. And that you are kind of the editor, producer, director, writer, and star of your own reality show.
That's an interesting take on that about, what, so finding happiness through almost like narrativizing your own life?
Well, exactly, yeah.
That's interesting. Because I sometimes think that's an interesting take on that. Because I actually sometimes wonder, just kind of to myself, whether the constant narrativization we all tend to do on social media in some way undercuts our happiness and doesn't allow us to view things for what the, you know, just in that time and in the moment.
I spend hours flitting through Facebook because I'm super happy. Right? That's how it works, right?
Right? Facebook. Sponsor us. No, it's an interesting take. I think they actually, so it's unclear. So here's a question for you. Do they actually have a TV show? It's not totally clear to me.
I don't think they do. I always thought they kind of did, but.
That there might even be a spinoff. It gets real high ratings, but it's not totally clear to me.
Isn't there might even be a spinoff? I actually read that as like, they might have a kid, but they're not sure about that.
I like your read of that.
I think there's like one other song that I want to kind of close the loop on, and then wrap up. I think we're gonna go a little shorter than usual. There's two songs. I want to talk about the second half of the album a little bit. So one of the two songs on the second half that I think are really compelling are Artists Only, which starts the second half. So it's right after Found a Job. And then The Big Country. Mm. Perhaps I'm wrong, but Artists Only might be a little deeper in. Right. So Artists Only is about is about this idea of being creative, right? Of what he says, and it is after that, right? So it's like, I'm painting again. I'm cleaning my brain. And so I think that that is like interesting. It is a relationship and another side of this of like, why make this art, right? If you are this aware robot and it's, I'm cleaning. He's like, right? So it's like also like another side of this like dump. It's like, so actually it's interesting. He's actually taking this like putting this all out. There is a kind of like emotional hygiene that's going on, and a kind of a cleanse. And so the art is about cleaning the brain. And this is really interesting, right? So he says, I don't have to prove that I am creative. I don't have to prove that I am creative. All my pictures are confused, and now I'm going to take me to you, right? And so it's like through this art. Right. If I'm like kind of can't communicate with you because I'm just like so uncomfortable, at least I will make this art and you'll get me and you'll understand me.
No. And then I think you want to focus on The Big Country next.
Yeah.
I think The Big Country, this kind of ties back to the what's a song about buildings. I think The Big Country is one of these very... you know, these songs about space in buildings. I mean, I would kind of call it the song of... it's like a flyover state.
Exactly.
Song.
Well, yeah, it's like David Byrne hated the flyover states before it was cool, mm-hmm. right? Right, it's the big refrain is, I wouldn't live there if you paid me. I couldn't live like that. No siree. I couldn't do the things the way those people do. I wouldn't live there if you paid me to, right? And so that's like where he's like definitely non-basic, right? and he had some begrudging. I guess it's healthy. I guess the air is clean, but it's...
Look at that kitchen and all of that food. Songs about buildings and food, people. Look at them eat it. Guess it tastes real good.
Right. Well, it's also then, like, it's interesting to comment on even the banality of, like, of most conversations and contents of life, right? Mm-hmm. And right, this is, like, an interesting thing where... And this is kind of a different... This is, like, the robot... has become sarcastic, right? Because it's very different from like, I'm doing this, I am operating, I'm cleaning, there's a good line between me and the good thing, and it's like, you know, oh, and by the way, fuck Nebraska. You know, fuck Nebraska as an agricultural production zone, as a homeland, and as a motherfucking crew, you know?
And if you like Nebraska, then fuck you too.
No, seriously though, not us. We are post-Bernians. We love America. We love this big country, so we're not saying that. But David Byrne, on the other hand, you know, rides his bicycle from his home in Brooklyn to the Barclay Center to do a guest song with the Arcade Fire. Right?
He's made his choices.
Yeah, exactly. He knows where he belongs.
No, it's. I agree that the voice of this is very different from, for example, the voice of The Girls Want to Be with the Girls. Right, where there's much more of a choice. There was much more of an effort to have that stilted the stilted tone, the kind of stilted, distant tone. And this sounds a lot more personal. This actually sounds like a sentiment that might have come from David Byrne.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So it's interesting to hear through, like, even though there's a dominant voice, there are then these other voices that are expressed here. And they're, again, it's not a totally, polyvocal, but there, it's like, it has that same kind of, like, flatness yet depth that is kind of evoked by the, flatness with depth that's evoked by the production style as well. So it's both kind of, there are multiple perspectives here, and yet they're not as manifold as, like, say, Bowie or something like that, and who's dealing with kind of, and what we talked about with Heroes. So any other parting thoughts, Rachel, as we wind down?
Well, just thinking a little bit more about the girls want to be with the girls. In some ways, I now, given what we've talked about, I'm viewing the girls not so much as girls, but sort of about the, you know, they are just a stand-in for people like David Byrne, for the artists, for the people who are using up their emotional RAM, but not internalizing norms, but processing the norms that they know they're not living by. You know, they have, and the unintelligibility of these people to others, to the basics.
Right. That's really interesting. So for, it's like, David Byrne doesn't really believe in basic bitches. He believes in basic bros, right? Mm-hmm. And so the girls want to be with the girls, and there are just emotional girls, right? They're emotional. Mm-hmm. There are kind of social political structurings that kind of fit with. The girls want to be with the girls is a kind of a political act in a way.
Right, and almost girls as just sort of the being marginalized.
Those who are others.
Those who are others and marginalized.
Yeah. Also, are you an author? we are less marginalized. This is a safe space here at TFT. And so join the conversation, as always, on Twitter. You can join it at TFT Podcast. You can also join the conversation on the show notes at overthinkingit.com. We're going to be back next week. We're going to keep marching through the late 70s for a while. We have a few detours and trajectories that we'll take on our way. And then we'll swing within the next month or so back to contemporary music. But Rachel, thank you for coming by the podcast. It's always great to have you.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure being on.
Yeah, and you know, we I'm glad you like David Byrne became more human over time, and I think gave your emotional RAM a break. So we can all do that as well. That we can, even when we're tense, even when we are feeling our most robotic and processing really hard what's normal, we can just take a deep breath, stare at whatever we like, or just close our eyes and be real.